This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
And our mission was to push back whatever Russian brigade or division, armor division it was. And your life expectancy of the guys up front is 45 minutes. So it's our job to make it 50 minutes.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Manuel Alzaga returns to the podcast after his debut in episode 57. He returns with his experience as a US Army 18-year-old assistant artillery gunner in West Germany. He tells of his first impressions of West Germany, details of the 1982 Reforger exercise, that's the Return of Forces to Germany exercise, as well as the life expectancy of a frontline soldier on the East German border should the Cold War have turned hot. Now, if this podcast was a magazine, you wouldn't mind paying a few quid or a few dollars a month, so I'm just asking you to support us for the bargain price of $3 a month. You join a select band who help cover the show's increasing costs and keep us on the air, and you also bask in the warm glow of being an official supporter of the podcast. And don't forget, you also receive the much sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate, or you can use the link that displays in a number of podcast apps. So, back to today's episode. Manuel's story starts as he steps off the plane at the Rhein-Main Air Base, which was the primary airlift and passenger hub for United States forces in Europe. We welcome back Manuel Alzaga to our Cold War conversation.
We landed in Rhein-Main, and it was in the afternoon, sometime in September of 82. Beautiful. And I remember we were bused from Rhein-Main, not too far from Frankfurt. And I don't remember exactly where, but they had these giant warehouses. And there were climate controlled, and they were fenced off with barbed wire. And they were ran, basically, with the U.S. military and civilian contractors. So they bused us from Rhein-Main to this massive warehouse facility, maybe half hour, 45 minutes south of Frankfurt. And my first time on the Autobahn, cars are just zooming by you. You know, everyone's all just bright-eyed and bushy-tailed because we just slept 8 hours. And we got to the checkout points in the warehouses. What happened there is we had an advance party leave a few days earlier from our unit. Each unit had an advance party. Mm-hmm. And they basically had everything ready for us to go. So we literally got there and we packed up our gear, our duffel bags, our backpacks. We checked our weapons. We did an inspection of the M110. We didn't have any live ammunition. I remember that. I kept thinking we're going to draw live ammo. And no, we're not going to do that. Okay. Yes, sir. We fired up the artillery piece, a howitzer, and we had this checklist, and then we all lined up within a matter of about 6 hours, and it was a beautiful sight. Okay, just four M110 howitzers roaring, and behind them we had what was called the M548, which was basically they carried the ammo, and then we had another vehicle called the Gamago, where like the XO rode in. We had the FTC track, and it was just a hoorah moment, I guess you could call it. You know, we're getting ready to go. But I just found it strange that we didn't have any ammo. And again, the advance party had a lot to do with that. They did the paperwork. I guess, a guess at the vehicles and make sure everything was in order for us. And then we convoyed right outside the gate, I think it was. And we got a briefing, a simulated situation that hostilities have broken out and the whatever tank division from the Russian guards was coming into the fold of gap. And our mission was to hook up with the advanced brigade of the 1st Infantry and to push them back. And, you know, that's where everyone started getting all excited and pumped up. And any questions, and, you know, they were given maps. And our mission was to push back whatever Russian brigade or division, armor division it was. And if they were coming in droves and were calling for reinforcements, and your life expectancy of the guys up front is 45 minutes. So it's our job to make it 50 minutes. You know, some of the humor that happened in those days probably wouldn't fly now, but that's what they said. And then we got a motivational speech by our battery commander, who got it from his battalion commander. And, you know, hoorah. And some of us said our prayers, like if we're really going into battle. And that was the whole idea. And then we got on the Autobahn heading towards Wurzburg. And I remember that clearly because my job was to get on one of the 548s and do the 50 cal and man it. And you're sitting up there and all these cars are going by, you know, beautiful cars, clean country. You know, I've never seen such a cleaner country in my life than in Germany in 1982. And then I remember people driving by and waving at you, giving you peace signs, and some of you giving you the middle finger, you know. And it's like, well, what's all that about? Well, my sergeant, he was there before. He said, well, not everybody likes us over here. And I found that interesting. You know, again, I was 18. It's like, why wouldn't they like us? It's like, you'll find out. You'll find out. So anyways, yeah. To be young and naive, right? But we convoyed down towards, and like I said, I remember Wurzburg because we passed beautiful castles. And we set up a perimeter. And we bunked down for the night. And it wasn't far from the, I'm not sure it was the Rhine River. It was a river. And there was a little village called Moos, M-O-O-S. Mm. And we're supposed to bunk down. And we're going to rotate guard duty. Because the next morning at 0500, we're going to move towards the border and support. And I didn't understand that. It's like, well, if we're going to get there and help them and they're dying, why are we bunking down? Well, you know, in a real life situation, we'd head right to the border. But since it's not, we got orders to bunk down because of traffic. All right, whatever. Yeah. And of course, me and other 18, 19, 20-year-olds, privates, specialists, we can't sleep. We're excited. We've never been to Germany. Some of us have never been out of the country or our home state. And I remember kids driving by in bikes and waving at you and saying God knows what, but it sounded friendly. And they're motioning with their hands, like to their mouths. And, you know, being a smart ass little 18-year-old, I said, what do they want? They want us to feed them? And my section chief, Staff Sergeant William J. Guynup from Troy, New York, great guy. He said, no, they want our sea rations. We still had sea rations back then. This was pre-MRE. Right. I was like, yeah, if you have mine, I don't want this piece of, you know what? And I said, no, they'll trade you. So we get the chocolate bars. They're called John Wayne bars. They're like these little round chocolate bars. They were good. And sea rations. And, and someone wanted cigarettes. And I know now it's not okay. But back then, 1982, you know, we give them some cigarettes. And they're like 15-year-old kids or something. And they'd either take them to their parents or smoke them. And then my sergeant says something to them in German. And I had no idea what it was. But he said, you guys want any bread, any brotchen? And I said, is that bread? He said, yeah. So these kids took off, and I'm thinking, they ripped us off. Dumb kids, you know. When they come back, I'm going to shoo them away. They can't be in here anyways. But lo and behold, about an hour later, you know, these kids come back with these long pieces of bread and butter and jelly and apple juice, a lot of apple juice, because I guess they were just in their harvest season. And it was really cool. They were very nice kids, and they were talking to us in English and asking about America. And, you know, try to tell them, well, you know, it's okay, it's fun, but I like it here better. No, America's better. America's Asbesten. And my sergeant said, 999, Deutschland ist über alles, Nummer eins.
Yeah. Were you told how to deal with civilians as part of your training or not?
Yes, absolutely. This happened closer as we came to our deployment date. I remember somebody from battalion coming in and training us and giving us some very basic information like good day, you know, guten Tag, auf Wiedersehen, danke, thank you. And also that we were ambassadors from a country, that we were representing the United States, and that we were not to let them on our vehicles, we were not to fraternize with them, we were to be friendly, and to never point a weapon in their direction. Absolutely not. We followed the weapon law, obviously, but everything else went out the window when we got there. It's like, yeah, come on in. We'll show you, you know, the big bullet, the artillery, and this is C-ration, and this is my helmet. And, you know, there were kids.
Yeah.
And also some farmers were very nice. He brought us, like, baskets of apples. And you know, I remember nobody really had issues. But the main thing we did follow is that don't point a weapon at anybody, nobody. And that was followed. But everything else kind of went out the window in my section. And, you know, there was talk of like, well, maybe we should get him some beer. And my sergeant said, nope, you're not going to do that. I'll grass your ass. That was the saying back then. You have to wait till later for that. But we're also told a little bit about the history, how East Germany and Warsaw Pact were the enemies. And they may invade West Germany someday. Thanks to your program, actually, and your podcast, I did get that book on Operation
Able Archer. Yeah,
and I read most of that book already, and it was just shocking to me that the Russians and Warsaw Pact thought we would invade them. To be quite honest with you, Ian, we were ready to invade anybody. I mean, we were just building up. Right after Reagan took office, we still had stuff from the Vietnam War. Morale was getting better. There was a lot of drugs and alcohol from my point of view. I'm not saying everywhere, but at least where I was at. But that was changing as I was coming in. So I got to see that transition from very bad leftover Vietnam era to more of a esprit de corps, more pride in America. But the briefings that I got, I know you asked me the question, I went off on a tangent.
No. I like tangents. I told you that.
Let me read myself back in. We were told basically some of the courtesies, that how we should act, like when we're on leave, be respectful. If we damaged anything, we're supposed to report it to our section chief right away, because we had these giant artillery pieces. And they would tear up the cobblestone rolls. And that was expected. But like, let's say we ran over a mailbox. We're supposed to let the section chief know. We're supposed to wave. And we're supposed to stop the whole convoy and say, you know, there's been some damage done, rear echelon, something like that. And a jeep would pull up. And I guess it'd be damage control. I don't know what they would talk about. But then the convoy would move on. We were told to respect the fact that not all Germans were Nazis. And again, as an 18-year-old, that was new to me. It's like, oh, okay, this was basically something that happened, but they all didn't support it. A lot of the Germans really don't want to talk about that. They told us that too, to not make fun of Nazis and anything neo-Nazi related, that they're a good country. They're our allies, they're one of our strongest allies. And economically, we support each other. And also, we had a little class about sexually transmitted diseases and how some Fräuleins might want to be with you even if they don't know you, and some of them are wanting money, some of them are not. So, but I never got to deal with that, unfortunately. But we're told that. We're told about tipping. I remember, and the mark exchange rate. Wow, Ian, you're making me think about things I haven't thought about in years. But we're going to they told us, like, after the maneuvers, we're going to have a little bit of time off. And what the exchange rate was, at the time, for $1, you got about 4 marks. And again, I didn't know what that meant, but all the sergeants, the older guys, like, oh, yeah, yeah. So basically, you had a lot of money to exchange, and it was a good exchange rate. They also talked about the potency of the beer, and you got to be responsible and only have one beer. And also, they cautioned us, I think this part's at the very end, I guess, to make more of an impact, about Russian spies and Warsaw Pact spies, how they're everywhere. And you got to be careful what you say. Even at a bar or a pub or a restaurant or whatever, people may ask you questions and you're not to say anything. They gave me this little card with, I think it had a Russian flag. You're supposed to call this number. And, you know, I was at this bar in this city and they asked me this question. This is what the guy looked like. That never happened to me during Reforger. Later on it did when I was stationed over there. But during Reforger, they said there's a lot of spies. And again, reading, you know, some of the books and listening to a lot of your podcasts, I realize that now, how vulnerable and how prevalent, I guess, espionage was at the time.
Are you saying that somebody approached you later on then that you had to report?
Yeah, what happened is...
Well, we might save that if that's later on anyway.
Okay, yeah.
Keep the listeners...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
On the edge of their seats for that one. That sounds like an interesting story.
I don't know about that, but okay.
Your lagered, I guess, is what we'd call in the British Army with your unit next in this town of Moose. And then the next day, the exercise starts proper, does it?
That's correct. But we got up 0400 maybe before daylight. We had a quick chow, which consisted of sea rations. Back in those days, sea rats were cans, and A rats, I think, were the hot meals. So we got sea rats, and we lined up, and we were given the order. And we went around, again, the Würzburg area, and we were, I think, the blue team. And we had colors. And what happened is we'd be on a convoy, and this is not in the training site. This is out of the country. You know, most people think about Grafenwehr and stuff like that, but this was on the country. And then we'd get a radio communication, or the front track, the FTC, would make an arm hand sign, and we'd be pulling off, and our advance party would be there, or someone from the infantry, forward observer, and would say, like, fast track, come over the radio. That means be prepared. We're going to get off the road and set up for fire missions. Fast track, ETA 5 minutes, ETA 4 minutes, you know, jump off point, coming up, follow convoy. And then we get off the road and go into what was just harvested, the dirt fields. And then our ground guides would direct us in the direction we'd point the guns. And then that's when we went into action. We set up what's called a collimeter, which is basically a prehistoric compass system. And then we have to lay radio wire to FTC. We had the spools, and we had to lay it and run across and hook it up with them. They run back and test the radios. And then we'd have to, we didn't have artillery rounds, but we'd simulate that we were loading rounds, and we'd have to have one in chamber, just a general one, or have one on standby, and then have an order we'd have to have a high explosive round, a loom round, maybe a white phosphorus round, and all that was simulated. So it was easy. And then we'd have to set up the tents. I mean, I'm sorry, the nets. And these are the camouflage nets, and they were a pain in the butt. I mean, everything would get stuck on there. You had web gear and your equipment, you get stuck up on there. You have to put it up, and we had to do it like in 15 minutes. So we're pretty good. And since we didn't have any live artillery rounds, boy, we did it quick. And we'd report, you know, section one ready for action, gun two ready for action, gun three. And then when everyone reported out, we'd have to have other people, usually the lower ranking, they had to work their way up to the guns, or the support personnel, like maybe the cooks and stuff, they'd form a defense perimeter around our firing point, our firing base, if you will. And then when all that was communicated, then we get the green light and a FTC, and this is all by radio, fire line standby permission. And that could last anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour. You had to be ready. And then all of a sudden you hear fire mission, and everyone had to say fire mission, stop what you're doing, you go to your positions. In my case, I was the assistant gunner. And I'd go up there, and over the radio, they'd say, quadrant, blah, 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 deflection, blah, blah. So start doing the elevation, blah, blah, blah. And you have to repeat every order. Mm-hmm. And then after they gave you the coordinates, it'd be round, HE, fuse type, time, point, 9-8. And then the gunpowder, that came to last. A charge five, which means you cut into pieces. It came, I think, in 7 or 8 increment pieces. And I think charge 8 was the farthest you can have. So charge 5 bag. And then you have to repeat everything. And you have to do it like within 2 minutes. And then you stand by, and then you hear battery stand by. And at that point, I learned a trick where I would pull the lanyard back up until I feel that pressure was going to click. And then you have to wait for the fire direction officer, usually a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant, would say, battery standby, battery, fire. And the point there was the first one you got out, you know, you were the hot shot. But again, we had no ammunition. Back in the live fire range, that was an honor and actually something to work for. But this was all simulated. Everyone fired at once, and there was no problems. And there was no misfires. So we would do that all day, and then we would move. Then they'd say, breakdown, ETA, departure, 1325, and it's 1310. So guess what? You had to pull down the net, you had to reel in the comma wire, any charge bags, you had to put them in the section that would be burned later, and you had to pack everything. And then they'll give you the marching order, gun one, gun two, gun three, gun four. And we'd have to line up, and then we were all ready to go. We do that again until when we kept going until he told us again, you know, the 3rd Infantry needs support in this quadrant. So that would come down from battalion, and then it would come down to the batteries. And we have to do that all over again. Move, yeah. Shoot, communicate, at least tell us in the artillery. And again, the fact that we had no live artillery rounds made it easy. But still, all the movement, all the taking down, yeah. All the traveling. And this lasted, I guess, maybe for about 2 weeks with very little breaks. The downtime was like when you were waiting for a fire mission and, you know, you maybe sneak out, hey, chief, I'm gonna go take a piss. Hey, chief, you mind if I go to that little village over there? And you weren't supposed to. I hope I'm not getting anybody in trouble 35 years later, but my chief, God bless him. Yeah, but you better not get drunk. All right, I just want to go in, maybe buy some drink and a soda or something. Okay, well, bring me back a candy bar.
How quickly could you, I mean, if you're going down a road and then you get the order that second division needs support, how quickly could you then deploy and be ready to fire? What is that sort of time frame then?
My memory of that is we were pretty darn quick. It takes me about 15 minutes from the time we got the order that we were breaking track, which meant we're going off the road,
yeah,
and everything ready to set up to fire. It would be like you know, 15 minutes. Yeah. Another piece I just remembered about, and it's been many, many years since I thought about, we had what were called hip chutes. And what that is the whole convoy stops and we load artillery piece, either one, two, three, four, all of them, or just one. There was always an adjusted piece, which is usually the best gun section. And they would say, hip shoot, gun one, stand fast. And the whole convoy would come to a break. And we'd actually load artillery rounds and fire them. Now, again, this didn't happen in Reforger, but back at Fort Riley and Fort Sill, we would actually do that off the road. They're called hip shoots, right off the road. It's yeah. like someone needs our help immediately. And I think that would be within maybe 3 minutes from the time we got the order to the time we actually pull one off the cannon, crank one out, as he used to say.
Yeah.
It would be maybe 2 to 3 minutes. And there was no time to put up any nets. It was all done by radio or this seems so weird now, but we'd yell it down the road from FDC all the way down the line. FDC is going to say, gun three, hip shoot. Gun one would say, gun three, hip shoot. We'd repeat, gun two, gun three, hip shoot. Quadrant, elevation, fuse, round, powder, ready, fire. And the fire direction chief, I'm sorry, the fire direction officer would have a little red flag and he'd hold it up. And then literally, it's like in the races, when it went down, that round better be shot. And those happened with actual live rounds at Fort Riley, at Fort Sill, at Fort Bragg. But and when I was and Reforger, we didn't have that. It was just all simulated.
Right.
So everyone did great.
Yeah.
And in Reforger.
Did you say you had armor piercing rounds as well?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay.
We had high explosive rounds and they were basically designed for close range of 15 to 25 miles of accurate impact. Armor piercing rounds, that as an old artillery mount, sounds like a direct fire.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, is whether you were trained at all ever to fire over what I'd call open sights.
You know what? In boot camp at Fort Sill, we had a direct fire training. And it was this old tank at the end of a hill. But in terms of like my actual experiences, we didn't do that. At least not in my units, in my career. The only time I did direct fire was in boot camp. And I don't remember what kind of round it was. But basically, you're shooting straight ahead like a gun.
Yeah.
And most of our missions were high elevation, low elevation. The higher the elevation, the closer the target, obviously. And the lower the elevation, the farther. But no, to answer your question, I never did a direct fire armor piercing mission outside of boot camp.
Yeah. No, so, I was just wondering. I mean, obviously, if you were having to do that, you were in big trouble anyway, I guess, if the enemy was that close. So within this exercise, you weren't even firing blanks then. You were just pretending to fire, effectively.
We were simulating.
Yeah.
What it
simulating
was...
Simulating sounds better than pretending. You're right.
Yeah. Reforger 82, and I don't know about later Reforgers, but Reforger 82, there was no live fire. There was no ammo. We did guard duty without live ammo. And again, that struck me as odd. But, you know, that's what it was. In fact, we never even went to an ammo dump when I was on Reforger. So a lot of people are happy because guess what? We don't have to clean the cannons when we're done. We don't have to clean our rifles when we're done. Looking back, it was more like a show of force, coordination, the practice, going through the motions. And I'm sure there was live fire exercises on Reforger 82. But not in the unit I was at, because again, we weren't in Grafenwehr, we weren't in there was another Cornfell, I think it was called. I'm sure they did a lot of live fire there, right. But like in the villages and stuff like that. I know the infantry used the red caps on their M16s, you know, the blanks.
Yeah.
And they had a little red screwy thing on top of the
yeah.
of the muzzle. We didn't even have that. We had no live ammunition.
Well, they were probably, yeah. I mean, you know, they probably want to minimize the damage because potentially you'd still break windows even with blanks, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, there was, and I never saw them, but there was, I heard a lot of accidents with live ammunition, with other units. But it was also cool because we got to train with the French, the English, and the German, the Bundeswehr. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun too, you know? So, yeah, now I'm sure someone probably did train with live ammunition on Re-4-32, but it wasn't me. And like I said, we were happy because we didn't have cleaner rifles. We didn't have cleaner guns. We didn't have to lift all that stuff. And everyone was proficient.
Yeah. Yeah. And how, I mean, with these exercises, they've normally got umpires running around saying, you know, whether you've hit something or you've been hit and stuff like that. Was that going on as well?
Yeah, I remember that clearly. There was like, we were, I don't know, let me think about it for a second here. We were like the blue team, for example. We were the Americans, NATO. And then OPFOR, opposing forces, they were like the red team or the orange team. And what umpires would do, they'd have like these big, maybe neon crosses or X's on their jeeps and on their vehicles. And they would go back and forth after, like we did a hip shoot, for example. Mm. They would come by, they go to the BC, the battery commander, and say, okay, you suffered casualties, the target was diminished, move on. They would make the call. And I don't know exactly, because again, I was a specialist, I think, an E4. I wasn't really an NCO. I wasn't an officer. But the umpires come around, and they had helmets with colors, and they would say, yeah, you're dead. And the battery commander would say, okay, gun one, you're dead. And we'd sit there for a couple hours and sleep or goof off or, you know, read a book. Or they would say a target was destroyed, objective reached, next objective, move down the road and be ready to support the 11th ACR or something like that. So I do remember umpires, and I think they were a combination of American and Germans, if I remember correctly, or maybe German observers. Mm-hmm. I heard rumors that there was Russian observers. I never got to see that. I wanted to see that. But mostly it was officers in jeeps would drive around and say, you're dead, or you have to, you know, you did the target, you destroyed it, you move on. And, okay. You know, now that I'm looking back, I wish I asked more questions. Like, well, how did that work? But that's basically what they did. Yeah. Umpires were all over the place. And sometimes there are disputes. I remember my battery commander get into an argument with one of them. And I don't even remember what it was, but, you know, we did destroy the target. We were the first ones here, blah, blah, blah. And then the Fulbright colonel got involved, and I don't know what their decision was, but back in those days, you did what you were told, and you were dead, you were dead. And yeah. Actually, I remember when they said you were dead, we'd get kind of happy because that means we got to lay around for a while.
Yeah, no.
Also, Ian, going on a tangent still, we did a lot of NBC training, nuclear, biological, chemical. We had to have our mop suits, and there was a simulated chemical round went off 2 miles away, and it came down from the fire direction center to the firing line, and you have to yell, gas, 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 drop everything, put on your gas mask within, I think it was 14 seconds, and you had to suck the air out of that and blow it back out, and then you had to put on the, as I said, mop one, I think just meant your mask. If it was mop two, it was your mask and gloves. And please forgive me, my memory's kind of foggy there, but I do remember mop four meaning you had to put the whole thing on. And, you know, when it's hot out, you know, in Germany it doesn't get that hot, but still, you have to walk around in those things like for 2 hours until they say all clear. We had a lot of that. And right. I remember saying, well, you know, the Warsaw Pact, they will use chemicals on us. So that is something we trained on a lot, mop four. And it was brutal because, like I said, it was very uncomfortable. And trying to, you know, handle a rifle or sit a quadrant or an elevation, even walking around. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but it was really hard to, and plus all your other gear on top of that, you know. Yeah. It's like it made it very cumbersome.
Yeah, I've seen those suits, and I think, you know, they, I can't remember the estimation, but the efficiency of the troops diminish massively with having those on, and really difficult to see through as well, because the, you know, the goggles would you know, misstep and things like that.
Well, I wore glasses most of my life, and back in those days, they would have little lenses made for you, and they had to be on there just right, or else you couldn't see anything. Plus, it would fog up a lot.
So you had, like, prescription headgear? Yeah.
Yes, I did. My mask had a prescription headgear, and every time you went to a new unit, you had to take them with you, and you had to sign for them. And someone, I think the NBC NCO at your unit would make sure that was squared away. But that was another thing, just me wearing glasses most of my life. It's like, I can barely see those things. They were little back in those days, like little brown spectacles. And plus, you couldn't eat, you know?
Yeah.
You can have water. You can have water. We had these little tubes that tied on. Well, not tied on. They basically clipped onto the top of a canteen cap. Mm-hmm. And you had to raise your canteen upside down, hold it up, and you could drink water through that. But that was it. I mean,
yeah. But then you wouldn't want to have too much water either, because it's got to go somewhere later on.
True, yeah. And I think that's the whole purpose. Just to experience what it would feel like. Yeah. And on top of that, if it was an actual chemical attack, you know, the consequences if you didn't follow that.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you also had to work with the Bundeswehr and the French Army and the British Army. How was that? I mean, how did you get on with them?
We got along great. At the time, I remember.
You don't have to say that because I'm British, you know, Manuel. You know.
No, I'm talking about the French.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. At the time, we were told that the French were uncertain. And I think they're a part of the 5th Army Corps. I think it was the 5th and 7th Army Corps, which consisted of many divisions. And the French were in the South. And I remember, I still have a beret. In fact, I showed my wife. It's a black one. I got it from a French guy. I traded one of my, you know, BDU caps for it. We got one great on the field. And I remember seeing the British and just waving and looking at their tanks. And I was more amazed at their equipment than anything. Instead of, like, relationship-wise, I really didn't, you know, hey, how you doing? You know, waving at them. But I was more in awe of all the equipment. But I do remember clearly that British and German relationships were really good politically and economically. The French were so-so. And again, this is early 80s. Later on, and I was stationed in Germany, not part of Reforger, but I was actually assigned to Germany for about 2 years. And I was stationed in a German army base. They were called Kaserns. And I love those guys. They were great soldiers, fun to work with. We used to party a lot. You know, they were top-notch soldiers. And the Germans at the time were drafted. I don't know if they do that now in Germany, but the Bundeswehr used to draft. And this is the second assignment. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I have nothing but respect for the Bundeswehr. The British, we used to fight a lot in the bars. We trained with them. And like I said, I had very little contact, just the fact that there they are. Hey, wave at them. You know, maybe talk to them a little bit, trade some stuff. That was, I think, pretty common, you know, trading memorabilia, I guess you call it. Even sea rations and food, little insignias. But my real bonding, I guess, came with my second assignment in the military when I was with the Bundeswehr.
Okay, and we'll come on to that in a moment, because I'm interested to talk about that. So Reforger finishes. Did you get any time to have a look around Germany, or was it straight back on the Pan Am 747?
Yeah, we were told, because a lot of people asked, we're going to get any time off. And what's interesting is a lot of the NCOs which were older than me, late 20s, early 30s. They've been in for a while. They've been in Vietnam. They made their career. They were maybe staff sergeants, sergeant first class, at C6 and E7. They've been in Germany, and they've had relationships, or their wives are from Germany. So a lot of the questions that were asked at this briefing, are we going to get any time off? And, yeah, we're going to be assigned to whatever barracks, the current barracks that the U.S.'s forces had or the German forces had, and they would set up tents, massive tents, in the parking lots, and that's where we would be housed. And then this is towards the end. I think we're on the field maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And the last few days, it was very nice. We were told to pack one set of civilian clothing, and then we could sign up for bus trips down the Rhine, to castles, to churches. Or you had to travel in groups. And like, let's say the highest ranking person was in charge and made sure you behaved. So I remember I signed up for a bus tour of some castles, maybe around Frankfurt. And then also just one night getting liberty, we're restricted to the base. And some of the sergeants asked for special permission to go see their relatives or their in-laws, and that would be granted. But that was what is called RHIP. Rank has its privileges. And they would get extra time off. Yeah. And yeah. I was, you know, an E4. And, well, if you're going to go downtown tonight, you have to have a permit. You're going to go with your buddies. This guy's in charge. And I remember doing that. And I remember seeing Frankfurt a lot, Wurzburg, the castles along the Rhine. And my big thing is, you know, I'm a metalhead. I'm a rock and roll freak. And my first thing is when I went into Frankfurt, I went to one of the record stores and I bought the new Rush album just because of the German pressing. And I thought to me, yeah, that was the coolest thing in the world. And of course, the pubs, the gasthouses. We were given a couple times off. And then they would also do this. They would have, in the period of like the 4 or 5 days we actually had off, we would clean all the equipment, make sure it was ready for turn in. And then at night, we would have these things like, you know, you go into town or the USO is going to put on a concert at the base and there's going to be beer, but you can't leave the base. So it was a multitude of different choices or the choices they gave you. So we're able to do that. And I remember that is we got to just walk around, you know,
yeah,
downtown Frankfurt and enjoy a schnitzel, have a beer. And they encouraged that, actually. When I mean they, like our officers, but they also made it very clear that one person has to be in charge and you better behave and you better not get totally drunk where, you know, you get in trouble because then the police side is going to get you.
Yeah.
And they used to scare us with that because they would carry machine guns and they played no games with police side. You know, they'd beat you up and throw you in jail if you misbehave. They didn't care who you were.
Yeah.
So they always held that over our heads. But we did get like USO shows. I remember one night, again, many, many years later, I have this memory just now. There was a concert that one of the U.S. Army bands gave, and it was the German Army was in the audience and the American Army. And then they sang like some traditional German songs, and then the German troops started singing along. And we had a beer call after that, and that was really fun. You know, you got to talk to your counterpart, and they curse that because, you know, they're your counterparts, they're your allies.
Yeah.
And I remember that night being really fun. Also, they had it all planned. You had to have you had to go through the process of getting the equipment checked in. And there was a lot of downtime. And they'd find things for you to do. You know, police call. Well, we're going to go over to this German army base and we're going to do a police call and break up their rocks or pick up their trash. Kind of a PR stunt, if you will, you know,
yeah,
good relationships. So there was downtime, but they tried to keep you busy. And in all fairness, they did give you some taste of what German life was and what it had to offer. So it was kind of well-balanced.
If you'd like to learn more about the subjects covered in this episode, do visit our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app, or visit coldwarconversations.com. If you like what you're listening to, you can really help us by leaving reviews in Apple Podcasts, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast app. This really helps raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where our guests and listeners, just like you, continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod and Instagram, where we are at Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.